Hey, ladies and gentlemen, this is Trevor T. Trujillo coming at you just to let you know. We're working on some great stuff for you coming down the line here at the Nighthawks Cafe. We've been very busy. Coming up in less than 2 weeks, we have our on-location coverage of Fantastic Fest. That's right. Matt Foster is going to pull up stakes in Parts Unknown, Utah. He's going to make his way down. We're going to have on-location team coverage of Fantastic Fest, so stay tuned for that. Also, coming up next month, it's October, it's Halloween season. Folks, we have the sequel to Monstoberfest right here on the Nighthawks podcast. So for all of your horror movie talk, to get your pumpkin juice flowing, tune in right here next month. In the meantime, while we're prepping that coverage, we decided we'd do something nice. We want to get something out there. You're still very much on our minds, and we still very much love you. So we did something that we did before and had a lot of success with. We reached back into the vault and pulled out an old episode that had never been aired before. This originally was supposed to be our episode 11. This episode was unfortunately shelved as a result of the passing of Wes Craven, who ended up getting the episode 11 tribute, and we did a full episode devoted to Wes Craven and his films. As a result, this one just kind of sat on the shelf, and to be perfectly honest with you, the production value on this is not our best. It wasn't even good for us at the time, and we have progressed by leaps and bounds since then as well. So those elements are still here. We're showing them to you, warts and all. But I thought this was still a great episode. It's got some great content, and we wanted to bring that for you. And what's better is you're going to see the genesis of several ideas that came up in later episodes of the Nighthawks podcast. Chief among them, the most recognizable being the format that we're using. In this episode, we're comparing and contrasting a movie to its source material, which we would later do in one of our most popular episodes, The Unfilmable, William Gibson, where we compared the Keanu Reeves movie Johnny Mnemonic to its source material, a short story by William Gibson. We're doing the same thing here today. And so, folks, without further ado, here it is.
The Unfilmable H.P. Lovecraft.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get the Texans.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is
all in. All right, do you want to intro or do you want me to
11,
do it?
10, 9. Ignition sequence start.
I like it when you do it. You like it when I do it?
4, 3,
mostly.
2, they mostly come at 1, 0, mostly. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on 11.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Nighthawks podcast. You are joining us now, and we thank you for joining us for episode 11. We are officially over the hump, the 10-episode hump. We're on the other side now.
Is that an official hump?
Sure. Are there rules to podcasting? I don't know that there's...
Are any humps actually official is another question, I guess.
That's true. Time is nothing but a construct. Episode numbers are nothing but an illusion.
Now, I hear that like 60% of podcasting is actually made of dark matter. Tell me then, who are you and why are we listening to you?
Well, I am Trevor T. Trujillo. I'm a film critic over at fanboytv.com. I am one of the co-hosts of this podcast, and I co-host that podcast with you.
And I'm Matt Foster. I am the other co-host.
You also write reviews for fanboytv.com?
Off and on, yeah. It has been known.
And you are listening, of course, to the Nighthawks podcast, which, as we mentioned, we co-host together. It's the cinema podcast for people who like to stay up late like we do.
And this one, in the name of podcasting verite, we're actually taping it well after midnight.
Yeah, we're doing a good thing. It's, you know, the whole idea was kind of, you know, one of the best things you can do afterwards, if you're going to a movie socially, going to the movies is actually a terrible activity, because you sit in a dark room, you're encouraged not to talk to anybody, and everybody is paying attention to a flickering wall for 2 hours. You know, it's not the greatest social activity in the world. What is a great social activity is, after the movie, going to a coffee shop or a cafe, having a cup of coffee, and talking about what you just saw. So,
sure. Our younger audience members need to be reminded that's what we did before we went straight home and bitched about it online. Man, get off my lawn!
So, for episode 11, we decided we were going to do something a little different. This time around, we thought we would take a movie, as we are wont to do, but we also decided to take a look at the source material and kind of maybe compare and contrast. And in this case, we decided to take a tip from early turn-of-the-century speculative weird fiction.
We're going a little bit down the rabbit hole to confront what some would call the unfilmable.
You know, and I think there's a lot to that with this author. It's H.P. Lovecraft, and one of the few directors who has tackled H.P. Lovecraft several times, usually to pretty good effect, is Stuart Gordon, and we are going to be discussing the Stuart Gordon film Reanimator, compared and contrasted with the source material, H.P. Lovecraft's Herbert West Reanimator.
Lovecraft has a kind of love-hate affair with the cinema. A lot of Lovecraft adaptions have been loose and or bad. There's definitely been some wrong turns down the road of a almost as rough in his run-ins with Hollywood as has been Stephen King.
You know, I'll agree with that. I guess, when did you come into the world of H.P. Lovecraft? Are you a fan? I mean, I know you're familiar, but do you consider yourself an H.P. Lovecraft fan?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm a little bit of an odd one, because my personal favorite H.P. Lovecraft novels are probably The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath and the At the Mountains of Madness.
I do love At the Mountains of Madness, and that was one I kind of put off reading. Lovecraft has a very unique style, and some would call it maybe a little archaic or a little off-center. So it takes some getting used to when you're first reading him. And At the Mountains of Madness, and for that matter, you know, a lot of the Dream Cycle, are longer pieces. I think At the Mountains of Madness was essentially a novella.
And Lovecraft, it should be noted that Lovecraft was writing probably in the 20s and 30s, and he was deliberately trying to, his writing was a little bit like a Deadwood or a Game of Thrones. He was trying for, he wanted it to sound earlier than it was. He was doing sort of period pastiche writing at the time, so now it sounds double old.
Lovecraft was a big Anglophile. He loved England, he loved old kind of waspish stock people. You know, the elephant in the room that you have to address with Lovecraft, especially to somebody who might be reading it for the first time, is that Lovecraft was very much a white man and a product of his time. He was not very racially tolerant of not only black people, but also immigrants of any kind. He wasn't big on Jewish people. He wasn't big on Italian people. He wasn't big on the Irish. Basically, in order to be in his good standing, you had to be English. And that's about it. But he was a bit of a hypocrite in this regard, as he also ended up marrying a Jewish woman at one point in his life. And several people have pointed to different relationships he had with people that he normally shouldn't have got away with or shouldn't have gotten into if he really espoused these beliefs wholeheartedly. But and many people theorize that by the end of his life, he was kind of turning around on some of these things. That's a discussion for a different podcast. you know, I'm not going to get into the...
Well, you know, like I often say that part of the disconnect is them people on TV are different from the person like that, you know. Like there's a flaw in people's thinking where they don't realize when they talk about immigrants that they're also talking about Mr. Ramirez across the street. And so it's not that odd that when you look at people, especially someone Lovecraft's age, that he would have handshake relationships with the people in his neighborhood that had almost nothing to do with his take on world politics, you know?
And just to kind of give you a handle on what era we're talking about, specifically the short story, which was serialized at the time, so it's broken apart into several different chapters. But Herbert West Reanimator was written between 1921 and 1922, from about fall to summer, is what's theorized. Not long after that was picked up by a publication, a pulp weird fiction magazine called Homebrew, and started to begin being serialized in July of 1922. And so what you get, especially when it's collected like this, you kind of have to remember what a serialized story would be. If you subscribe to literary magazines and that's something you're into, you'll know what we're talking about. But basically, they publish a chapter out of the story in each issue. So in order to get the whole of Herbert West Reanimator back in 1922, you were probably buying five or six copies of this magazine.
Yeah, it was a sort of old publication model. I would say kind of sadly has fallen by the wayside.
Of Herbert West, who was my friend in college and in afterlife, I can only speak with extreme terror. This terror is not due altogether to the sinister manner of his recent disappearance, but is engendered by the whole nature of his life's work, and first gained its acute form more than 17 years ago, when we were in the third year of our course at Miskatonic University Medical School in Arkham. When he was with me, the wonder and diabolism of his experiments fascinated me utterly, and I was his closest companion. Now that he is gone and the spell is broken, the actual fear is greater. Memories and possibilities are ever more hideous than realities. Herbert West, Reanimator, by H.P. Lovecraft. Getting into the meat of the story, I suppose, it was a six-part story, and each part deals with this mad scientist, Herbert West, and it kind of follows him as he's coming up through medical school and then on into his career through the eyes of your narrator, who, through the course of the story, remains nameless.
I find the narrator character kind of interesting because he's almost... It's a sort of codependent thing where he tries to he's clearly quite complicit in everything, and he tries to sort of shunt it all off on West that he's just the follower.
And that's important because what Herbert West is up to, like I said, he's kind of a mad scientist. What he is trying to do and what he theorizes is basically that the human being is a construct of material run by a brain that is run on electrical impulses, and that is true. But where Herbert West takes it is that once that computer, once that brain shuts down, it's just a matter of being able to get the right electrical receptors firing again, and you can bring the dead back to life. And so he's kind of made this his life's work. And through the course of the story, he's, like I said, he starts off in medical school, and his ideas are very frowned upon, pretty summarily dismissed. So it's something that he has to kind of carry on research in private. Through the course of the story, he gets involved with the narrator, and the two of them are carrying out these experiments, and by the end of each chapter is where they've kind of gotten to a point where they begin human testing, and it all goes horribly wrong, generally with the people becoming reanimated, but they're definitely a shallow, hollowed-out husk of the person they used to be.
It's almost like a stealth anti-science story, because the implication is that you simply can't bring the people back without their souls. All you get is a angry reanimated body. This is where I don't quite know how we should approach this, but this is where I felt the written story was a little better tonally than the movie. The written story, first off, it spans the entire sort of political era of World War II or World War I. You know, they're in the trenches in the war, and then they're dealing with a TB outbreak. I believe it was it afterwards or before? They live a very kind of vulture-y existence, going wherever there's enough mayhem to cover their experiments.
Lovecraft considered this, for the most part, a humor piece. It is a contemporary to Lovecraft redux of the Frankenstein story, but done as kind of a comedy. And the running joke in the whole thing is they have this reanimation fluid that they inject into a dead corpse. The dead corpse then gets up, runs amok, maybe kills a few people. Some of them engage in cannibalism, create big problems for the city at large. And Herbert West's reaction to all this is always, well, I guess it wasn't a fresh enough body, you know?
It's very, very gallows kind of dry, sort of tut tut cheerio. The joke is almost that his upper lip is too stiff, you know?
Yeah. Going through some of the specifics of the story, there is one part in here, in the story, this is where we kind of preceded this, talking about the elephant in the room being Lovecraft's innate racism. And there is the one chapter in here, it's titled Six Shots by Midnight. And the two doctors are working in a community that are surrounded by immigrants. So Lovecraft does not have a lot of good things to say about the townspeople. But there is a prize fight, an underground boxing match.
And to be fair to Lovecraft, he was not just racist as we know it today. He also had some unique prejudices against the the Welsh and the Cornish and the Polish or something that were made up the laborers at the mine. Yeah.
And so there's this underground boxing match going on. One of the contestants is killed. This boxer is killed in the ring.
My ass puckers when you say it.
And that's how he describes it. I mean, that's not the PC term. I felt a little weird saying it myself. But he dies in the ring. And because it's an underground boxing match, they kind of go to these doctors that live on the edge of town who say, oh, no, we can make this go away. Just don't tell anybody. They take the body back, and this just is an example of how these things go wrong. They inject it with the fluid. Eventually, this man reanimates, but he is literally almost more animal than man. And he ends up escaping, he gets out, and pretty soon there are children missing from the town. And people have been attacked, people have been killed. And at the end of the story is talking about when the door opens up to the doctor's house, Herbert West fires all six rounds of his gun into the thing in order to put it down.
It is uncommon to fire all six shots of a revolver with great suddenness when one would probably have been sufficient. But many things in the life of Herbert West were uncommon. Herbert West Reanimator by H.P. Lovecraft.
And so this is kind of where he's on the precipice of discovery, and then it all goes wrong and he destroys it. And it's almost like he's enjoying this. He's got kind of a weird sadomasochist thing going here.
There's an indictment of a simultaneous sort of paradox of a fascination with medical science and an indictment of how sterile it is. Like they, you know, what's the little crack the narrator makes about religion? Like he's sort of given it up, but it's sort of an allusion to Pascal's wager. He's given it up, but it'll hedge his bets a little bit.
So where this all ends up going, several of their creations are kind of out in the world now. And they've managed to separate themselves from any kind of scandal. There's one that's locked in an insane asylum. There's a few who are out and about. There's one who is a headless corpse. And so basically all these creatures continuing with this Frankenstein theme, are now kind of banding together and chasing after Herbert West. He is now a man pursued. And so that's kind of where we end the story, is that we get the idea that this headless corpse is kind of uniting all of the experiments gone wrong, and after that, they are going to go after West.
And then, as the breach became large enough, they came into the laboratory single file, led by a stalking thing with a beautiful head made of wax. A sort of mad-eyed monstrosity behind the leader seized on Herbert West. West did not resist or utter a sound. Then they all sprang on him and tore him to pieces before my eyes, burying the fragments away into that subterranean vault of fabulous abominations. West's head was carried off by the wax-headed leader, who wore a Canadian officer's uniform. As it disappeared, I saw that the blue eyes behind the spectacles were hideously blazing with their first touch of frantic, visible emotion. Herbert West Reanimator by H.P. Lovecraft.
It's very different in tone because it implies that they've plotted against him for years.
Yeah.
That they've been keeping score and biding their time the whole time. Versus, I guess we'll come eventually to Reanimator, the movie, where it all sort of unfolds pretty quickly.
So, Matt, what did you, overall, what did you think of the story itself?
I liked the story a lot. I listened to a book on tape version because we don't read anymore. This is society has transformed into Bill Hicks's Waffle House. So... And I thought it was pretty solidly creepy. It had the occasional dry chuckle. I think perhaps that intended humor was a little lost on me as a modern reader. But all in all, it was a pretty interesting story from a modern story structure standpoint. It holds up pretty well.
It's not one of my favorite Lovecraft pieces, and he wasn't necessarily fond of it either. To be honest, he was his own worst critic throughout his entire life. But this is a story that he was actually commissioned to write. So he was writing it with the intention of profit, and he considered it a kind of a sellout story, and that people who write should write for themselves and those who write for money are inferior. And since he was writing this for money, he was never too particularly fond of it. But coming back around and starting to bring the movie into the works, this is probably one of his more filmable stories, because it deals a lot with things that are observed and seen. And that is a heavy theme in Lovecraft, is that a lot of his creatures, a lot of his stories involve an unknowable, unnameable, unfathomable, inconceivable creature that drives you mad just to gaze upon it. You know, how do you translate something that like that to the screen? It's hard. But with Herbert West Reanimator, this is something that it's very narrative and it's very linear, and what you see on the page can translate to a film.
Sort of fandom and literary culture are divided as to whether Lovecraft was visionary or if he was using a cheap crutch when he did that. And I tend to think that Lovecraft was visionary when he did it, and Derleth was using a cheap crutch.
Well, and you know, that's a discussion for another time, is how I would love to shake the hand of August Derleth, because it is because of him that the work of H.P. Lovecraft was kind of held on to and was cataloged and then later collected and published long after his death. But at the same time, Lovecraft encouraged his writer friends to kind of write in his universe, in his mythos. And Derleth kind of abused that privilege, did some not great things with it. So on one hand, I want to shake his hand, and on the other hand, I want to break his fingers so he's not able to write. That's probably another conversation for another time.
It's worth noting that it was one of the first sort of open shared worlds, and that brought good and bad into it.
You know, it is weird.
Interesting little side tidbit is it's one reason, along with like the Greek classical deities, it's one of the Lovecraft pantheon is mentioned in Dungeons and Dragons quite a bit.
Dungeons and Dragons, and Robert E. Howard, who created Conan, was a a corresponding friend of Lovecraft's, and they borrowed from each other from time to time, which is kind of cool to see a Lovecraft-inspired creature show up in a Conan story or vice versa, some of the gods referenced in the Conan pantheon being mentioned in Lovecraft.
They were definitely doing something a little different back then.
So I do want to talk a little bit about the... Well, I want to talk a lot about the movie. Reanimator, or H.P. Lovecraft's Reanimator, came out in 1985. It's a kind of a science fiction horror comedy. Once again, directed by Stuart Gordon, who he kind of got his start directing live theater in the city of Chicago.
Herbert West is at the top of his class in medical school.
How can you teach such drivel? These people are here to learn, and you're closing their minds before they even have a chance.
What are you? He's brilliant, but a little weird.
I've broken the 6 to 12 minute barrier. I've conquered brain death.
His experiments have always been unorthodox.
It was dead.
But lately, they're getting out of hand. And he's just made a discovery that could wake up the dead.
Herbert West has affected reanimation in dead animal tissue.
What are you thinking? How do you feel?
You? 15 cc's of reagent being administered.
Once you wake up the dead, you've got a real mess on your hands.
Where this project started out, interestingly enough, is they were going to pitch it as an idea for a miniseries, like a 6-part miniseries, where each chapter of the story was going to be an episode, and they were pitching it for PBS, for the Public Broadcasting System. And so...
Oh, huh. I did not know that.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell that by the time it got to feature film status, things had changed quite drastically. There is a lot of gore in the film. It's a pretty good gorehound film. There's a lot of nudity in the film, both very clinical and also very salacious nudity. They definitely earn their R rating in this one, which probably would not have been the case if they were adapting it for PBS.
Well, yeah, and it's got a weird tone, like a weirdly weird bounce between fairly substantial gore and scares, and then fairly comical things happen as well. And it really straddles the line between unintentional and intentional comedy. I never know when I watch Reanimator with a group of people if they're going to laugh at the right places.
So, Matt, do you want to run us through a quick synopsis and maybe highlight some of the differences between the movie and the book?
The movie version follows a medical student named Dan. Dan would take the place of the narrator in the original written version. He's sort of the analog. He is a medical student at Miskatonic University, the sort of not Boston College of the Lovecraft universe.
Yeah, it was a fictitious... university set up by Lovecraft in his he set most of his stories in New England, so Miskatonic was kind of his stand-in for Brown University. And Miskatonic was actually quite famous in his stories for housing a large collection of rare and forbidden books, which, you know, you can imagine in the world of horror were great MacGuffins and kind of, you know, very very nice things to throw back upon, that, you know, the Necronomicon that a lot of people know from Evil Dead or Army of Darkness.
Necronomicon Ex Mortis, the Book of the Dead. Found in human flesh and inked in blood, this ancient Sumerian text contained bizarre burial rites, funerary incantations, and demon resurrection passages. It was never meant for the world of the living.
That is an H.P. Lovecraft book that is housed at Miskatonic. Forbidden books with forbidden knowledge of the cosmos that man was never supposed to know, that type of thing.
So we have Dan, the medical student. He's a fairly happy, very white-bred, upstanding young man. And he's dating the dean's daughter.
Played by the very talented Barbara Crampton as Megan Halsey.
Yeah, that's correct. They end up taking on a boarder, and the boarder is a controversial medical student, a very outspoken student who, at the beginning of the movie, we see him coping with the fallout and aftermath from an accident that kills his mentor. I don't want to get too spoily, but he is studying in Europe. There's a terrible accident that leads to the sort of death of his, I don't know what you call him, his sponsor or his advisor. And he's re-enrolling in school in the United States. And he's a very outspoken critic of the department head at Miskatonic that both he, and this is Herbert West, and this is, he is quite a, setting himself up to be a professional rival to the department head both he and Dan study under, who he feels ripped off his dead mentor's ideas and concepts. And so Dan, somewhat reluctantly, basically because of the need for ready cash, rents West the basement of their house. West is, of course, not a particularly reassuring character, and proceeds to basically creep out friend and family and fiance, and stuff goes downhill from there. Hilarity ensues.
Well, one of the
hilarity of the reanimative variety.
One of the things that we have to point out is, like we said, the story takes place over a long span of time. And so with Herbert West kind of going from somebody who is really eager to bring the gift of life to those who have departed, he kind of goes to the point where, by the end of the story, he's actually murdering people so he can try and bring them back. And it's kind of a slow denigration to this person who is very focused on the result and not really caring about the means to which he gets there. In this case, we start off with Herbert West being a pretty amoral character. And one of the first things he does when he moves into the house is he kills Dan's cat, puts it in the freezer. And when Dan comes home to find this, Herbert's like, no, it died naturally, but it's okay. It's okay. I can bring it back. And takes out this vial of green glowing fluid, injects the cat, and the cat comes back. But the cat is very, very angry.
Does the cat come back the very next day?
You better believe it. And so it is with this that you kind of see the corruption of Dan, played by Bruce Abbott, by the way. You see him kind of become corrupted reluctantly, but he's pretty wowed by the power that Herbert West is wielding and kind of becomes a reluctant partner.
Yeah, it's sort of a, well, the cat was already dead, honey. I might as well, there's no harm in me looking at the experiment at that point.
And what they actually managed to do is they bring the cat back, kill it, and then bring it back again. And by the time it comes back the second time, it's like it's got its back broken, it's very mangled, and so it's kind of this very disturbing image. But you really see that corruption coming in for Dan because he is very, very excited about this fact. Something else that the reanimation fluid can do is it's not dependent on having a full human body. It at one point, Herbert West manages to stitch together a couple of fingers and an eyeball on an optic nerve and reanimates that into like a little spider creature. And so that's when things really start to depart from the book. If they had intended to kind of keep with the story in a 6-part miniseries, things really go off the rails pretty quick in the film version.
Yeah, it's a much quicker and dirtier train wreck all around.
And it, like you said, it takes place over the course of days as opposed to years in the story.
The element of Dan being involved with the university and being involved with the faculty member's daughter sort of changes it, because in the story, the institutions involved are kind of absent parents. In the story, West is clever enough to get away with whatever he needs to. In the film, they're a little more bumbling, and they have a greater foil in the institution of the college, and that leads to a plot divergence, which is their choice of victims. Subject. Their choice of subjects is such that a few obstacles are removed from their personal lives, and it's
Yeah, basically what you're dealing with when it comes to the college as an institution, you have two antagonists. You've got David Gale playing Dr. Carl Hill, who is kind of the chair or the dean of the School of Medicine. And he's the one that kind of locks horns with Herbert West over various theories. You've also got Barbara Crampton's character's father, Dean Alan Halsey, who is also an instrumental foil in Herbert West's way. And it's between Dr. Hill and Dean Halsey that they kind of conspire to shut him down, both of whom end up meeting an untimely end and then subsequently coming back for seconds.
Hill in particular has a rather unsavory ulterior motive.
Through a scuffle with Herbert West, ends up getting decapitated. Herbert West takes off his head with a shovel. And then because, oh, hey, look, free corpse, he injects both the head and the body with the reanimation fluid, animating them into two separate entities, which is kind of funny. To a certain degree, the body is still controlled by the head, but there's almost these cartoony, Warner Brothers cartoony moments where the body is trying, or the head is trying to tell the body where to go, and the body is just bumping into the wall or, you know, tripping over its own shoelaces, that type of thing.
One thing that's in both versions is the when the resulting entity has to get around, it places a kind of wax, probably plastic in the movie, but it places a anatomical dummy on its neck.
In place of its missing head, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it has it. And that actually is a rather creepy visual.
And so this also leads us to probably one of the more notorious scenes in this film, affectionately known as the head giving head. And it is a scene where Dr. Hill, who has been reanimated, kind of escapes from Herbert West, kidnaps the daughter of Dean Halsey and has her naked on the table, and
The body holds the head in various places for him to ogle and smooch and terrify the girl a little bit. And I believe there's nothing. I think she's restrained and can't do anything. Restrained and or drugged and can't do anything about it.
Right.
And it definitely, the movie caught some heat over it. It was not popular with certain authority figures, censors, and anybody eating lunch.
And certainly not good for PBS. So I don't want to get too much into spoiler territory, just in case we have a few listeners out there who have not seen this movie. But it is really a story about corruption, and by the end, that corruption wins the day. And where this really differs is that the story leaves Herbert West getting disemboweled by his creations. The ending of this film, however, is a little more ambiguous.
West kind of falls on a grenade off camera. He buys Dan time to leave with his precious research. He sort of dives on the horrible thing that he's created in the corner as a result of the serum gone amuck and reanimating half the morgue, which I believe Dr. Hill does for reinforcements.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Basically, Dr. Hill, it's never expressly explained, but you definitely get the impression that he's wanting to steal Herbert West's solution and present it as his own. So he starts doing his own experiments, and in the course of maybe minutes or, you know, less than an hour, he has reanimated the entire morgue of Miskatonic University.
Another thing that's kind of important to the setup is he has a degree of telepathic control over dumber, less fresh undead.
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of just uses them all as an extension of his body to kind of attack Herbert and Dan.
just taking the movie on its own merits and kind of playing from there, is this one you enjoyed?
I would say I enjoyed it. I'm not sure it has aged perfectly, but it's still pretty creepy. A couple scenes in it, I mean, they're boundary pushers. They're things somebody might not put in a movie today, you know?
Yeah.
There's definitely some nudity in it that is just salacious, and some other that is just clinical, like some stuff in the hospital where they show, you know, a naked older woman for no particular reason except that she's a patient being treated, and then she's a corpse on a gurney.
Yeah. You know, I've always really enjoyed this film. I think it's probably one of the better by-name Lovecraft adaptations. Even though it's not a faithful adaptation, I think they managed to kind of stick with the dark humor that Lovecraft was attempting. They brought it into the now, made it a little more modern. And so I think spiritually, they're very well connected. I think, honestly, people who are going to like this movie are going to like it for the same reasons that they like Evil Dead 2. And honestly, I think this would make a good pairing with Evil Dead 2. It's got a lot of the same sardonic kind of gallows humor going.
I liked it on the balance. I think the key thing they captured from version to version that makes it feel like a faithful adaptation, even though the specifics are all over the place, is probably Jeffrey Combs' take on Herbert West. That's what felt like the story to me. The obsessed, driven, unabashedly unpleasant kind of triumphant ascendant nerd medical student who incidentally reminds me quite a bit of the kid in Invader Zim. But that the intensity that he brought to it, and he became quite identified with it. I hope not too much to his detriment. He definitely brought the obsessive kind of darkness of the character out of the story.
No, which, and I think Jeffrey Combs does a fantastic job. And even, I mean, yes, it is very dark and very pensive and very serious, but at the same time, he still has a few zingers in there. I think there's, at one point, he and Dr. Hill being a reanimated corpse at this point, are kind of arguing back and forth, and he says,
"I'm very disappointed in you. You steal the secret of life and death, and here you are, trysting with the bubble-headed co-ed. You're not even a second-rate scientist."
"Ah, Mr. West, I'm actually glad to see you. It saves me the trouble of having to send for you."
"You'll never get credit for my discovery. Who's going to believe a talking head? Get a job in a sideshow."
I love that line.
The old dichotomy in culture was between humor and ridicule, you know? And West is someone who perpetrates ridicule.
Yeah.
And when wit, and not necessarily jokes and humor.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I like that. Yeah, and honestly, if you want to see how well Jeffrey Combs can stretch, because he's a phenomenal actor, he did an episode of Masters of Horror with Stuart Gordon, where they took another kind of horror story from a famous horror writer. They took Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat and did an episode based around that, where Jeffrey Combs plays Edgar Allan Poe and does a fantastic job. And as a matter of fact, following that, Stuart Gordon and Jeffrey Combs put together a one-man show of Jeffrey Combs playing Edgar Allan Poe in a stage play and took that on tour. And I got to see that actually a couple of years ago. It was really wonderful.
Oh, that sounds kind of cool.
That was actually at Fantastic Fest.
Oh, well, that doubles its cool.
So, yeah, I mean, definitely something worth checking out as far as I'm concerned. I don't know, Matt, would you recommend it?
I would definitely recommend it to people that are already horror fans. For sure, it's one you kind of almost have to catch. But
now is the time, though, that we play our official Nighthawks game. Should it be remade?
Boy, that's a toughie. I don't know. I don't know if Reanimator should be remade. As tempted as I am to say I'd like to see it with more modern effects, I'm not sure it would really do it much justice necessarily. But I will say that a different movie entirely could be made from the source material. one of my criteria for should it be remade is there more to be mined? You know, that's what drove me nuts about the remake of Let the Right One In, the Let Me In, is it was so slavish to the foreign language one, and there was much more story in the novel that was you could construct several different feature films out of the 800-page original novel or whatever it was. There's quite a bit of stuff they didn't get into, and I think that we see that here, because in Herbert West Reanimator, there's scenes that didn't get used, and if you had the budget and time, it would be interesting to see like the historical, the times and places invoked in the original are quite a bit more interesting than the wing of the college and the sleepy neighborhood that the movie takes place in.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a Herbert West Reanimator movie could and should be in the works, but I don't know that an update of Stuart Gordon's Reanimator is necessary. What do you think?
The thing of it is when you talk having, you know, better, flashier, new effects, I think a lot of the charm is the practical 80s, very, you know, lots of latex, I think they used some like exorbitant amount of fake blood in this movie. At one point when they throw a head against the wall and it splatters brains everywhere, and, you know, there's this apocryphal story that everybody on set that day was wearing rain ponchos because they didn't know how bad these brains were going to splatter. And there's a certain low-budget charm to all of that I think you would lose in a modern remake. However, a modern remake might be able to tap in a little more to the horror and make it maybe a little bit scarier, but at the same time, this book wasn't intended to be scary. So, you know, it walks a fine line. If I had to sit down and if it was my job to rubber stamp the green light or, you know, put it back in the pile, I probably wouldn't remake it. If it is remade, however, I'd be fairly interested.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I even agree that it's not intended to be scary. It's definitely, I'd say it's intended to be gruesome. It's not maybe intended to keep you up at night.
There you go. That's a good.
But it's intended to make your sandwich hit the floor.
So we probably should mention, since we're talking remakes, that this movie did have two sequels. Not done by Stuart Gordon. It was done by another director. Both of them kind of follow in that same kind of schlocky comedic vine, maybe even a little more so. We had The Bride of the Reanimator and then Beyond the Reanimator. Beyond Reanimator is about Herbert West in prison after, you know, his life has kind of caught up to him and the fluid gets out into the open and he starts reanimating people in the prison. One guy thinks that the reanimation fluid is a drug and he injects it as a living person that has bizarre effects as well. So, I mean, this has been mined. It has been done. And those are both also kind of fun movies. They're worthy sequels. But yeah, ultimately, I'd see a remake, but I'm not jonesing for one.
Instead of a remake, and really instead of giving too much of your time to the sequels, the one I tend to steer people toward if they liked Reanimator is the one I sort of consider to be its actual spiritual sequel, which is may have even come out first, but From Beyond.
Yes, also an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, also directed by Stuart Gordon.
86, yeah. But From Beyond is like Reanimator turned up to 11.
Since we're kind of on the subject of other H.P. Lovecraft movies, are there any other favorites that you gravitate towards?
Well, again, I have to plug From Beyond. I don't know that I'd say it's good or better, but it's definitely it's peak 80s horror. It borders on the territory of something like Basket Case, you know, where it's just like, what am I watching? It's definitely one where there is, particularly the first act, where they're setting up kind of, they use sort of a machine to look into a dimension that overlaps our own and reveal that all around us are creatures that are just kind of out of phase with us that we can't touch. And that's just a very creepy idea.
You know, the one that it's another Stuart Gordon film. It was called Dagon, but it wasn't so much an adaptation of the H.P. Lovecraft story Dagon as much as it was an adaptation of the Lovecraft story A Shadow Over Innsmouth, The Shadow Under. And it's kind of about a guy who finds himself in a derelict town that's been overrun with fish people, basically, or frog people. And it's one of those things where, several years ago, a guy made a deal with this demonic fish race, and they had begun intermingling and interbreeding with the humans, and so they're this weird hybrid of terrifying creature. And Dagon, I think, is good on paper. Unfortunately, Stuart Gordon was operating a little outside of his means in the special effects department, and so a lot of the CGI and the digital effects don't quite mesh, and unfortunately they rip you right out of the movie. So there is a caveat to that. Stuart Gordon also did a fairly good episode of Masters of Horror based on the story Dreams in the Witch House, and it was called Dreams in the Witch House. It was the first season of Masters of Horror, and that one was pretty good, with the exception of there's a creature in that story that is a rat with a human face, and that particular effect looked a little ridiculous. And so that's been kind of the problem, is the Lovecraft film adaptations we get never have big budgets. And so a lot of times the special effects suffer and they're not quite as up to par with something else. What I really like in a quote-unquote Lovecraft movie are the ones that are more inspired by Lovecraft than are direct adaptations. Coming to mind is John Carpenter's The Thing.
Well, I think before we get off message, there's one specifically worth noting, which would be the 1970 Roger Corman adaption of the Dunwich horror, which is a written Dunwich. I've been corrected on my pronunciation several times. I believe that's how a New Englander would say it, would be Dunwich. It's a looser adaption, but it does have a pretty good cast. It's got Talia Shire and Dean Stockwell and Sandra Dee. So it was kind of a rare Lovecraft piece that actually had a budget and some actors in it. So,
well, and in as much as a Roger Corman movie can have a budget, but I'll give Roger this much. The guy knows how to make a lot with a little. So, that one's definitely worth checking out as well.
Well, and it definitely, it's a fun, watchable kind of 70s kind of B-plus movie. If you like Hammer horror and you like some of the classic monster movies, Dunwich horror is a little it's a little lighter than Rosemary's Baby, but it's a little heavier than A Complete Piece of Fluff.
Yeah,
it's something you could show on USA Up All Night without a lot of editing. if we're gonna chat adaptions a little more, one I have to mention, I don't know, I'm a googling a little bit. Well, you were about to talk about The Thing. Well, the Thing definitely has some Cthulhuan or some Lovecraft aesthetic to it.
Yeah, it's a really good companion piece we brought up at the Mountains of Madness at the beginning of the episode. It's a pretty good companion to that. They both take place in the Antarctic. They both involve kind of shape-shifting monsters and people discovering things from space that man was not meant to see. It deals a lot in paranoia, which was a big thing for Lovecraft. So spiritually, I think John Carpenter is able to tap into a thematic Lovecraft, maybe not necessarily a direct adaptation, but is able to tap into him thematically very well.
The second piece I'd like to make a point of mentioning that's not explicitly a Lovecraft piece, but directly mentions him at a couple points, is also a John Carpenter movie, and it's In the Mouth of Madness.
Which I love, In the Mouth of Madness. I love that movie so much.
I thought you were going to finish an idiom there. How much do you love it?
I love it so much.
I took it out to dinner last night.
I want to take it behind the bus barn.
I took it out to dinner last night and didn't ask to come up for a drink.
Yeah.
Just real quick, it's Sam Neill is this insurance investigator. And he's been called in to investigate the disappearance of a very... It's almost a hybrid. It's what if Lovecraft had had the same success as Stephen King? You know, somebody with Lovecraft's absolutely twisted imagination, but who actually succeeded in life and made a great deal and was very popular. The books in this movie have kind of a weird effect on people. And so when the author goes missing, they call in Sam Neill as the insurance investigator to kind of get to the bottom of it. And he ends up in a town that is right out of these books that this horror author has written. And so it's kind of a cool investigation, and we won't get too much into it because that might be a good episode further down the line as well. But
yeah, but and it's not it doesn't reference any it itself is not any one Lovecraft story, but it has a lot of borrowed set pieces, and like Sutter Kane's books are references to H.P. Lovecraft story. Like Kane's book is The Whisper in the Dark, and Lovecraft wrote The Whisper in Darkness. And there's the thing in the basement.
The thing on the doorstep, which,
yeah. So they're deaf. It's very much a winking nod to Lovecraft throughout.
You know, the reason that we kind of stumbled onto this episode topic is last month was Lovecraft's birthday. And I always kind of try and make it a point around his birthday to, you know, crack open my big Lovecraft tome and maybe see if I can't find something that I haven't read yet, or maybe reread one of my favorites. And every time, you know, I sit down to read a quick story and I become so involved. And instead of reading the one, I end up reading five or six, which is a great way to do things because it's a good way to kind of kick off the autumnal Halloween season. Is you start reading Lovecraft and then pretty soon you're into all this freaky mythos and these cool monsters and, you know, this, you know, shambling unnameable horrors. And it's a great way to lead into in through August and into September, October. It's really a wonderful way of doing things. So folks, if nothing else, go out. You know, as a matter of fact, Lovecraft, all of his solo works are in the public domain and are available for free online at hplovecraft.com. So definitely
can't beat free 99.
So definitely go out and check this guy out. I don't know that Reanimator is necessarily a story I would start people on. But, you know, if you want to start somewhere, The Rats in the Walls is a good one. It kind of deals with a lot of his themes like cursed family lineage and unknown horrors that reach back into the man's ancient history. And you're also kind of forced to confront the fact that Lovecraft was a bit of a racist. There is some racial epithets used in that one. So it's kind of it's a good litmus test of seeing if this is going to be up your alley.
The story version of From Beyond is not a bad quickie. And the actual, the titular and notorious Call of Cthulhu itself is actually very, almost kind of a Victorian adventure story. It concerns an ill-fated boating expedition. And it's definitely one you might as well hit if you're trying on a little Lovecraft.
All right, Matt. Well, any other final thoughts?
No, I have no further final thoughts.
Well, I've got a few. Just basically, Viva Lovecraft, despite his flaws, and they are many, he's definitely a fun read. If you can look past some of his unfortunate timely views, which were wrong then, they're wrong now. But, you know, the guy's been in the ground for several decades now. There's no use beating him up over it.
Yeah, we're lucky in that, like Birth of a Nation, the time has long passed when you're giving the guy any money by reading his stuff for free on the internet. So,
and on top of that, you know, it's much like Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation did a lot to harm race relations in this country, and I don't think H.P. Lovecraft did it any favors But the things that came from both of those people, from D.W. Griffith and from Lovecraft, are undeniably have their fingerprints on entertainment for years to come afterwards. Without Lovecraft, we wouldn't have Stephen King. We wouldn't have Dean Koontz. We wouldn't have Clive Barker. Well, you know, without D.W. Griffith, we really wouldn't have epic filmmaking as we understand it now.
I'd hate to give up King and Barker just to get rid of Koontz, but I would almost...
So, if nothing else, it's a good homework watch, and or it's a good homework read. You know, give yourself a sensation of where some of the things that you enjoy now in horror kind of came from. But I think that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Nighthawks Podcast. I'm Trevor T. Trujillo.
And I'm Matt Foster.
Check us out over on Facebook, the Nighthawks Podcast. On Twitter, we are at Nighthawks Pod. Have a safe and pleasant evening. And we're going to sign off because it's almost morning.
Toodaloo, everyone. Worst sign off ever.
Yes, Doctor. It's Herbert West. What are you thinking? How do you feel?
Stop.